Renegade economists Marilyn Waring, Kate Raworth, and Elena Ostrom, a TUC Radio miniseries on how to resist the demands of permanent economic growth and protect the earth, indigenous communities, local agriculture, and women. Beyond markets and states, polycentric governance of complex economic systems, by Professor Elena Ostrom. Elena Ostrom is best known for her understanding and defense of the commons. As one of the rare political scientists who continued to study reality first and then come up with a theory, she had personal experience with hundreds of community-managed fisheries, forests, and irrigation systems. In 2009, she was the first and so far only woman who was co-recipient of the Nobel Prize in Economics, in large part in acknowledgement of her work on the commons. Some say that in the year of the most severe economic crisis in our recent past, the Nobel Committee had a hard time finding male economists. Elena Ostrom is respected by so-called renegade women economists. They refuse to accept that exchanges among people and life within the ecology of our common home are only governed by states or the so-called free markets. Elena Ostrom was professor of political science at Indiana University until her death in June 2012. She and her husband, political scientist Vincent Ostrom, developed a worldview that they called polycentric. In 1961, Vincent Ostrom, along with two colleagues, published The Organization of Government in Metropolitan Areas. The article led to a conflict with University of California, Los Angeles Bureau of Governmental Research. The Bureau recommended in favor of centralization of metropolitan areas. This conflict prompted the Ostroms to leave UCLA for the University of Indiana. The Ostroms went on to define polycentrism, and with it the commons, as systems based on collective action, trust, cooperation, and the management of common resources. Polycentrism is also defined as attitude and openness to its other cultures, opinions, and ways of life, qualities that are so needed today. On February 16, 2010, Elena Ostrom presented an updated version of her Nobel Prize lecture. She spoke at Indiana University. Here's an edited version of her 30-minute talk.
One of the big lessons that I'll mention now and return to is that the rules that we use to govern a university, a private firm, a water resource, or any kind of problem need to fit the social ecological field that they're supposed to control. Having one kind of rule that will work everywhere is a ridiculous kind of thinking. A second is that polycentric systems with multiple scales enable a fit between human action situations, the day-to-day situations, and nested ecological systems. And I think you've all heard me at one time or another that panaceas are dysfunctional. So let's journey back to the 1960s. And at that time, complex human systems were considered chaotic. So if you had a lot of jurisdictions in a metropolitan area, it was automatically chaotic. You had to get rid of them. And some of you reading current events in Indiana will hear the same theme repeated. We have to get rid of all the townships, get rid of all the small schools. But there's not much evidence to support the presumption. So at an earlier point, the evidence was maps showing lots of lots of maps showing lots of units. Well, that's not evidence of of dysfunction. That's just a map. Vincent and Charles Thibault and Robert Warren developed a concept at that point of polycentric systems, looking at metropolitan areas and understanding having small units, medium units, larger units, very large units, enabled people to try to govern problems at multiple scales. What we found when we studied polycentric systems is that there were mechanisms that did make them better. One, the small to medium-sized cities were more effective in monitoring the performance of their own officials so they could figure out what was going on and correct it. Citizens who were dissatisfied with services could exit, vote with their feet. And local incorporated communities could contract with one another and say, gee, let's work together and see if we can't develop a contract of four or five of us or a small unit with the county. But the important thing was, if it didn't work, you could exit. And exit turns out to be a very important, powerful possibility for citizens. And if you have only big units, how do you exit? And we've got to recognize that today. Now, we did years of looking at police departments. I kid people that I've been in more police cars and more jails than almost any academic you know. And riding in the back seat of a police car on a rainy night with the dog was an experience that I'll never forget. But it gives you an understanding of what a police officer faces and the differences among communities and in the different departments and what they were rewarded for or not. In all of our studies, 15 years worth, we never found a single instance of a large centralized police department outperforming smaller departments serving similar neighborhoods in regard to multiple indicators of servicing the department directly. So then we went on to do a 80 metropolitan area study where we found those that did the most effective job had a large number of these direct service, the ones who do the patrol and immediately answer calls for service. On the other hand, we did find considerable economies of scale for radio dispatching, crime lab, and sometimes the training. And where people had figured out ways of having a large unit that would provide those services and small units to provide the direct, that's where the mix was the most efficient. And that was where the theory just didn't have it right. Our empirical evidence over the years rejected that theory. Unfortunately, there's still people who don't know that that theory has been rejected and are still arguing it. We really demonstrated that complexity is not the same as chaos. And if I guess there's any one message I want to get across, it's not that all complexity is good, but you have to evaluate it as complex related to what, to solve what. And we've had too much of a presumption that just complex is bad. Okay, that empirical work led to a doubling of the types of goods. When I was back in graduate school, there were private goods and public goods, and that was it. We added common pool resources. If I pull out fish from a lake, that those fish aren't available for anyone else. And it, also the problem of excluding. It, with the public good, there's a problem of excluding beneficiaries. Forests, water systems, fisheries, and the global atmosphere are all common pool resources. We also added toll goods as a fourth notion. So what we looked at was four types of goods that share two attributes. And I think the important thing is that even though we doubled the number of goods, these are only very large categories. The number of diverse public goods that exist that range all the way from a small neighborhood to the globe are immense. Similarly for common pool resources or private goods. So this just gets us started at a way of getting a much better view of the diversity out there. The next thing we did was to develop a framework called the Institutional Analysis and Development IAD Framework. Many colleagues here have contributed to that. It contains a nested set of building blocks that social scientists can use in their efforts to build theory and test it in diverse environments. So it's that complex net that leads people to choose outcomes together. And that enabled us to address this question: are rational individuals helplessly trapped? It turns out that some of us assign Garrett Hardin's Tragedy of the Commons to our undergraduate students. In some universities, it's assigned three times before a student leaves the environment, biology, policy program that they're in. And Garrett Hardin had the sense that, gee, you know, people using a pasture or a lake or something, they're helplessly trapped into trying to get as much as they can for themselves. The solution was to turn to other individuals. Somehow these other individuals are pretty different. They can solve it because they're officials, or the officials ask us to solve it sometimes. And government ownership or private property is presumed to be optimal, and there are times it is. But there's also the case that people self-organize common property institutions of a wide diversity of kind and sometimes solve problems very well. We finally were able to code 47 irrigation systems all over the world and 44 inshore fisheries all over the world. And there we found of the irrigation systems all over the world, 72% of the farmer-managed systems had high performance. The agency managed, the ones that had Asian Development Bank, USAID funding to come in and build very strong, fancy engineered works, only 42% of them were highly efficient. We found informal fishery groups that allocated benefits. We found all sorts of patterns out there in the world, but we did find that groups that did not communicate were more likely to overuse their resources. So if they didn't know one another, didn't communicate, they'd go in and grab, like what theory predicted. So that led us to a lot of clarification of concepts. One of the problems that we found is that people were using the term common property resource interchangeably with common pool resource. It took us a long time because common property resource mixes the notion of resource and the notion of a property regime. And so we had to slowly but surely sort that out. Then as we were looking at property rights, people would say, oh, those fishermen, they don't have property rights because they can't sell. They considered alienation of rights to be the ultimate. And yet we found that some people had access rights, withdrawal rights, management, exclusion, and alienation. And we found a mixture of these five rights that frequently worked very well, not just one. And we were able to get seven broad types of rules. So boundary rules define how actors get into a situation. Position rules create positions. Choice rules affect what actions an individual in a position can take. Information rules affect information, obviously. Aggregation allows control. Can I make this on myself, or do I need to have a vote and all of us be unanimous? Information rules, relating to how much you know, then payoff rules and scope rules. That helped us a lot. Then, after we had worked and worked and worked, I had the good fortune of having a sabbatical at Bielefeld in Germany, and I hoped it would be feasible to do statistical analysis to find the robust ones. Why were some of these better than others? And I thought, oh, we'll just do, we've got all this data now. We can do statistical analysis and find it. I failed. But finally, I decided to kind of move up a level. There seemed to be some regularities. And slowly but surely, we began to recognize that there were underlying uniformities. And I called them at the time design principles, that appeared to be there of the systems that were successful for a long period of time. The boundaries of the users and the resource system are clear. There is some congruence in the way they've designed it between who receives benefits and who pays the cost. The users do have some rights to making their own rules. This is really important. The users themselves can monitor one another or hire their own monitor. And they used graduated sanctions. So the first time somebody was found to break a rule, it was like a gentle little, hey, what are you doing? Why are you doing that? But then it would, next time if they didn't stop, it was, hey, what are you doing? You know, this is against the rule around here. And the third time, it might be a fine. The fourth time, it might be incarceration, whatever. It went way high. So this was a big puzzle to me, but we found this repeatedly around the world over time. They also had conflict resolution mechanisms, and of course you can understand that. Somebody starts to sanction somebody, and they say, I'm innocent, and you have conflict, you've got to have a way of getting that resolved. The ones that survived long times at least had some recognition by government at the highest level, and they were nested. So small, medium, and large were nested in one another or polycentric. Then we were able to take some of the findings that we used from game theory and inspiration from the field and put it in an experimental lab. And the benefit of an experimental lab is you can, one, do a game theory analysis and a mathematical model, carefully put that in the lab where you know what the theory says is optimum, have people respond. In most of our lab experiments, it was undergraduate from Indiana University, but ours have been replicated all over the world. And when they made decisions anonymously and there was no communication, they did what the theory predicted, just like we'd found in the field that when it was very big and they couldn't communicate, they overharvested. But all we had to do was introduce the possibility of face-to-face communication, which is referred to in game theory as cheap talk, doesn't make any difference. But that enabled them to increase cooperation greatly, and then we allowed them to design their own sanctioning system, and they went up to 90% of optimal, a fantastically positive result. And now we have colleagues in Colombia and Thailand and many other parts of the world doing field experiments with real users, not undergraduates, and we're finding parallel findings. Then we've studied irrigation systems in Nepal. We've gotten up to over 250 systems that we have studied, and we've compared those that were built by engineers and those which are very primitive mud and log systems constructed and run by the farmers. But we found the farmers were able to grow more crops, run their systems more efficiently, meaning the costs were less than the benefits by quite a bit, and get more water to the tail end of the system. We're now studying forests around the world. We've been doing this since 1992. We have the International Forestry Resources and Institutions Program. We're now over 250 forests. We're in 11 countries and just added China and Ethiopia. This program is unique. It is the only long-term research program studying forests owned by government, by private, and by communities in multiple countries. So we're collaborating with centers all over. We all use the same research protocols. We actually do a sample of the trees in the forest and hug them and measure them. And we talk with people about their rules and how they relate and how they're organizing. So we're measuring both social and ecological. We have some surprising findings for others. One of them is that in the forests around the world that we find that are sustainable, are either improving or not going down like so many, the users are active monitors of the level of harvesting occurring. The users themselves. This is basically what we found in the lab when they could communicate and monitor one another. They did a lot better, but we found it in the field. When we've examined trade-offs and synergies between the levels of carbon storage in forests and their contributions to livelihood, we find a very interesting synergy. It's not that carbon goes up and livelihoods go down. There are times and places where they both go up, especially when the users can harvest and they monitor one another. Now, we're trying to develop a further theory. We reject the theory of rational but helpless individuals. And we are now working with many colleagues in the development of a behavioral theory of the individual, going back to Herb Simon and his work on bounded rationality. People don't have complete information, but they can learn through time. They use heuristics, but they update their learning over time. And they have norms. They do have some value for what others obtain that varies by individual. It's not uniform, but we had taken norms out of the individual for earlier times, and now we really have to be serious about it. And given that model, we find that learning to trust others is central. You cannot have a small, medium, or large, or very large governance mechanism that works over time when people do not trust one another. So we put the long-term adaptive norm-using individual as what is affected by micro-situational and broader situational variables. And when people are able to achieve trust in others, they begin to engage in reciprocity and cooperation, and that produces outcomes. If they don't, the outcomes are bad, and so they go back and repeat it again and don't cooperate. But if the outcomes are good and they see others are cooperating and trust is growing, this is cumulative over time, getting better, until somebody comes along and doesn't act in a trustworthy way. So at the micro situation in the lab, in the field, we find that when people can communicate, when there's reputation known, when there's a high marginal return, when people can enter as well as exit, when they have a longer time horizon, when they've agreed on sanctioning, all of these factors increase the likelihood that individuals will gain trust and cooperate. So it's not just one variable, but it's how these work together. And communication is very important, but it's gaining trust that is essential. So now let's just turn quickly to the idea of reform. And how does all this affect the let's do better policy? And I think the important thing is that, again, I go back, the users who have good fishery, lakes, inshore fisheries, water systems, forests, biodiverse pastures, et cetera, or other resources, have long-term interests, and they invest in monitoring, and they trust one another. Many policy analysts and public officials have not absorbed this central message yet. That's why I keep stressing it. We've looked at a lot of government-protected areas and private ownership. There are some of those that work well, but not uniformly. And so posing it as the way, as some scholars have, is just not appropriate. Another key lesson is that we must learn how to deal with complexity, not just reject it. And all of this over time has dealt with the notion of polycentricity, and we need small, medium, larger, larger, global. We need all of those levels. But how we structure them can be quite different, and so let's not accept panaceas. And at this point, I have taken a long period of your time, so let me thank you.
That was political scientist Eleanor Ostrom with her lecture Beyond Markets and States, Polycentric Governance of Complex Economic Systems. This was an updated version of the speech she gave when she was the first and so far only woman receiving the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2009. When she died in 2012, she left behind a huge body of work that still generates more research and inspiration. Ostrom's early work emphasized the role of public choice on decisions influencing the production of public goods and services. Her later and more famous work focused on how humans interact with ecosystems to maintain long-term sustainable resource yields. Common pool resources include forests, fisheries, grazing lands, and irrigation systems. Eleanor Ostrom traveled the world to do her research. Her work emphasized the diversity of human ecosystem interaction and argued against any singular panacea for individual problems. Eleanor Ostrom was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in October 2011. During the final year of her life, she continued to write and lecture, giving the Hayek Lecture just 11 weeks before her death. This lecture is part of a huge archive of talks by her on YouTube. She died on June 12, 2012, at the age of 78. Her husband, Vincent, died 17 days later. On the day of her death, she published her last article, Green from the Grassroots, in Project Syndicate. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. And the mailing address is Post Office Box 44, Calpella, with a C, like cat, Calpella, California, 95418. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.